Welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Brandon Buddha.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. Today, we are going to be talking about The Men from Porlock by Laird Barron. This was originally published in 2011. It is a novella, and so we're going to do our usual thing here, which is to make a two-parter out of it. And this episode is going to be the recap.
This is also a commissioned episode. One of our very generous Patreon supporters commissioned us to cover this story, and we are always so grateful to receive these commissions. I'm really glad we got to dig more into the beautiful thing that awaits us all, the story collection that we read it from. It's always a joy to return to these collections and get more use out of them than just one story. And I really enjoyed reading this story, and I'm really excited to cover it. So thank you so much to our really generous Patreon supporter for getting us to read this story.
Yes, and the other story that we read out of this collection, Blackwood's Baby, was also a commission. That was a different listener, different supporter. But these are the only two Laird Barron works that we've done. And I think Laird Barron is, one, he's very important in contemporary weird fiction and also just a ton of fun. And we would not have read him otherwise. So yes, thank you so much for having us read this story that we just wouldn't have gotten a chance to do otherwise.
Well, this is a story that I think will be surprising to anyone who reads it. I, you know, a semi-seasoned reader, was surprised by every turn this story took. You know, we'll cover all that in The Lumberjack, but I will say up front, I really loved this story, and I'm really excited, as I said, to get into the discussion of it, especially looking at Barron's craft and putting together this story. But we can't do that until we actually go through the recap, which is this episode. So Glenn, why don't you get us started?
It's September of 1923, and we are in the Olympic Mountain Range in Washington. We're at a logging camp, and presumably it's not that far from where Twilight takes place, which is, you know, something fun to keep in mind while you're reading this significantly better story. And the story really begins with Barron giving us a run through of some of the loggers who are here, and I'm just going to follow his lead. Our principal character is Miller, who had been a sniper in the Marines during the First World War. Now, that was 4 years ago, but it is still the defining experience of his life. It's clear that he is out here in the woods logging in order to try to escape that experience, maybe even escape himself. But in addition to Miller, we also meet Olsen the Swede, who has a limp from a childhood injury, and Sven the Norwegian, who is missing his teeth and an ear from a logging accident. And we meet Manfred the German, who has a damaged skull from yet another logging accident. So the point is, this is dangerous work and the camp is multinational. And then there is Casper, who is one of several Poles working at this camp. In the evenings, Casper likes to write poetry and stories by lamplight. And as this story opens, Miller is actually teamed up with Casper, and Casper is telling him a bit about his life. Casper's brother was shot by a German sniper during the First World War. His brother had been in the Polish Blue Army in France, but Casper couldn't attend his funeral, and this is a fact that seems to really bother him. And Casper's sister also died, though that's much more recently, this time from cholera, and Casper couldn't attend that funeral either, which seems to be the thing that is really on his mind here. And so Casper's personal biography here is fairly bleak. In fact, everybody's biography is fairly bleak. All of these characters that Barron introduces us to have a bleak story in their background. And while you can't know it on these first three pages, I mean, you know, if you're reading this the first time, at least, none of these characters, except for Miller, are actually even going to be a part of the story that Barron is going to tell. But I love these characters.
Yeah, I do too. I have to say this, though, at the top of the show, you hinted to me at what the horror element of the story was ahead of time, probably some sort of, you know, content warning more than anything else, because we've become sensitive old men now that we have young children and babies in our houses. So when I was reading the opening of this story, I was searching for, you know, double meaning as to what the characters were eating and looking for how maybe this was going to turn into a Donner Party situation or something along those lines. And it took a little while for me to realize that none of what was going on in the introduction or prologue had to do with revealing the actual like supernatural horror element of the story. But even so, the opening of this story, the prologue, is full of, I don't know, setting and tone setting and character descriptions and so forth that do such a good job of situating Miller, who, as you pointed out, will become our main character, in a specific place and time. And we learn that these guys, these loggers or lumberjacks, as I'm sure I'll call them, they're already horrible. They're already surrounded by death and stories of death, even as they're trying to escape, many of them, what they came from, which was that aspect of World War One. I also can't emphasize enough just how strong these early descriptions of life in the lumber camp are. Perhaps another callback to Twilight here. Miller, in particular, reminds me a lot of Robert Pattinson's character in The Lighthouse, not Twilight. He's here to do a job for a while and try to make a boatload of cash and then move on. Robert Pattinson's character in The Lighthouse was also a logger. And I really think that Baron is doing a great job of creating some character motivations for Miller that we'll be able to trace through the story, even in the midst of all this extra detail work that informs Miller's world.
Yeah, I'd like to think that actually this is the prequel to The Lighthouse. That could be our headcanon.
It was for me as I was reading it. I'm not going to lie. It absolutely struck me that this is, you know, the prequel of The Lighthouse, and Miller's never going to really make it out alive, though we will learn what happens to Miller. Before we move on, I want to touch on what the title is referencing. The phrase person from Porlock or man from Porlock, woman from Porlock, men from Porlock refers to a completely derailing event, usually when someone by someone for someone who's doing something else. So, you know, this phrase goes back to Coleridge's writing of Kubla Khan, that brilliant unfinished poem that Coleridge claims to have received from a dream, though, you know, it's likely that opium was involved somehow. But after Coleridge had received this vision, he sat to write it down and was soon interrupted by a person from Porlock who claimed to be visiting on business. And when Coleridge went back to his writing desk after shooing this person away, he couldn't recall anything else about the vision, and the poem remains incomplete. So, you know, now knowing that, when I went back and reread this story, I realized if I had known that when starting this story, it would have really helped to orient me in the text a little bit. And I'd be wondering throughout the prologue, instead of searching for the horror element, whether or not somebody would be coming to the camp to interrupt operations in maybe catastrophic sort of way.
Well, in particular, we have just met Casper the Pole, who is a poet, or at least, you know, attempting to be a poet here. And so, in fact, especially because he also is given the most detailed backstory here in this opening segment, I thought he was going to turn out to be the protagonist of the story because of those two things.
Yeah. And like we'll see as this story continues, Baron, I don't know, must have a thick stack of rugs that he's able to pull out from under us at every turn here. and this is just the first of many.
Yeah. They all tie the room together, though.
They certainly do. Yeah. This story works.
All right. Well, we get some descriptions of the camp now, as well as the actual business itself. This camp is called Slango Camp, and it is the operation of a pretty small logging company called Bullhead and Company, which is just the perfect name for something like this. But Bullhead and Company are barely profitable, seemingly being profitable at all, mostly by cutting costs. And Miller assumes that the business will be bought up by one of the bigger lumberjack firms sooner rather than later. But at any rate, the camp and the job are pretty miserable, and Miller compares the morale and also just the quotidian experience of being in this camp to being in the trenches in France. And we get a powerfully written passage about this that I'm just going to read. The initial sullen mutters of exhausted men coalesced and solidified around him, and evolved into crude, jocular banter, fueled by food and coffee, and the fierce camaraderie of doomed souls. He'd seen it in the trenches in France between thudding barrages of artillery. the intermittent assaults by German infantry who stormed in with their stick grenades and Mausers, as Caspar said, and finally, hand to hand, belly to belly, and the sanguine mud of shoulder-width tunnel walls, their bayonets and knives. He seldom made sense of those days. The mortar roars, the fumaroles from incendiary starbursts boiling across the divide, eating the world. The frantic bleats of terrorized animals, and boys in their muddy uniforms, their blackened helmets like butcher's pots, upended to keep the brains in until the red, shearing moment came to let them out. So, it's another miserable day, but Miller is about to get a reprieve from the grind of this existence. He is summoned by the boss, who has learned that Miller's a pretty good shot. What he's heard is that Miller was a sniper, but also Miller has been hunting in his spare time, and that is actually what the boss needs him for. There is a photographer coming to do some kind of story on Slango Camp, and the bosses want to make a good impression, and good impression means good food. So the boss is going to give Miller 2 days off from lumberjacking in order to go hunting, and he's going to get to take a few other loggers with him, dudes who are decent shots. And we actually get a section break here, because this is now the real start of the story's plot, so we'll pause too.
Right. As you point out, the photographer is coming, and along with the introduction of the photographer, we get all of these references to awful lumber bosses and the corporate level of this company, and that with them come all these distractions. And so one might be getting the sense as they read this story that because Baron has given us such an excellent and richly detailed prologue that what's going to happen is that we as readers will be returning to the logging camp fairly quickly after a brief hunt, and someone from Porlock came while the hunting party was gone and did something terrible to the camp, and now they have to do some detective work or something to sort it out. But that isn't the plot, or at least not completely. The very end of the story has that element to it. But Baron does such an excellent job, I think, of letting this story breathe and find its legs. And there's a real function in this story to this prologue leading up to the real first act of the story. And I really find it to be an admirable bit of craft that this story is crafted so well in terms of its structure. What I also find admirable is Baron's characterization of Miller's boss, people like McGrath, but also of the bosses that we'll never meet. You know, Baron does a lot of work in this character of McGrath to introduce us to a character that we're not going to meet again. But McGrath felt really alive to me, maybe because we've all had bosses like him.
I agree completely. I really, really love the paragraph that I read directly into the microphone. I guess that's why I read it, this comparison of this camp to the trenches. But there is a real sense here, too, in which this organization, the company, Ballhead and Company, that Miller is working for now, reminds me of the army that we were in, you know, a century later than the First World War, or close to it anyway, 80 years later. Really reminds me of that type of organization. And I don't know if that's something Baron was trying to do intentionally, but it really, really worked for me.
This is something we're going to really dig into in the discussion, as I hinted at, is just the putting together of the story. The story seems so full of decisions that it might not occur to me to make. And as you suggest here, Glenn, what the intentionality behind them is maybe something that we can sort out when we get into our discussion. But I want to look at Miller now as he's being introduced as the protagonist. One thing that Baron does well in terms of characterization is show us that Miller advocates for his tree buddy for the day, a guy called Ma. We're going to meet Ma more in depth in just a bit. And just this brief moment where Miller is saying, well, let's get Ma off the tree too. He's super strong. We'll need someone to help us carry our deer. Makes us feel connected to Miller. Like, sure, he's young and trying to make some quick money, and he's trying even harder to get away from his memories of war, but he's also looking out for his teammates. And I love it. Miller's a great protagonist, and I think a great anchor character for a piece like this.
he has all of the feel of Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon. He's just got this sense of like, I was so close to retirement and now I've got this stupid adventure put on me that of course is going to turn out to be a huge disaster. Baron does all of that without ever really explicitly saying any of that. He gives us that feeling. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it's great because Miller feels like such an old timer, but he's like 23 and we're about to meet some of the real old timers.
Right. Yeah. Now we get introduced to the other characters who are in fact going to make up our hunting party, the characters this story is actually about. And this is a bit of a getting the band together scene, which is a thing that you and I both really love. Calhoun is the youngest. He's a kid really, but he's well-spoken. There's another guy named Horn. He's also young. Horn is from Kentucky. He carries a really massive rifle that looks like it's from the 1840s. There's Ma, who is short, but is in fact the strong man of the whole camp, and he's been brought along because he can carry a lot of deer. He's also Welsh and is sometimes just unintelligible. And then there are Stevens, Rourke, and Moses Bain. Stevens is kind of a straight man, but Rourke and Moses are old, grisly characters. They are a laconic team who are rumored to have served as scouts during the Spanish-American War. And these two, I love these two. These two are prepared to go on this hunting expedition as if they are going to be gone for months, and they might accidentally end up in Antarctica somehow, which is basically the only way I leave my house now that I have a two-year-old. And so I just really liked these guys. But yeah, that's the band. I'll say a few more things before we pause. The team hikes out about half a day and then makes camp for the night. As dinner is wrapping up and the drinks are being poured, Moses Bain, this is one of the old timers, he says, "There's stories about these parts. Legends, guess you might say." And this is met immediately by Horn, who's one of the youngsters. Horn says, "No call for that kind of talk while we're hunkered here in the woods at night. No, sir. No, sir." And wow, is Horn right. I'm just rooting for Horn, right, for the rest of the story at this point. But before we actually hear Bane's story, I want to pause, Brandon, because I have to say that at this point, I really thought that Bane's story was going to end up being the rest of the novella, that everything we'd gotten up to this point had actually just been a frame. Now, that is not going to turn out to be true, but I'm wondering if you had the same instinct here.
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to look at some of the frame story aspects of this novella, but this, yeah, Bane's story is a story within a story, but it's not going to take up the rest of the novella. And, you know, as I've been pointing out, there is so much misdirect at play here on Baron's part, so much playing with expectations. And I could totally understand and might even be sympathetic with, though I loved this story, how a grumpy reader might find that constant subversion of expectations to be a weakness in the story. Though usually we say that that's a strength, but it happens so often, it's hard to catch your breath. I don't find the way that Baron plays with expectations in the story to be a weakness. But I did find that, this moment in the story was the one moment where the scaffolding came through for me a little bit. You know, in terms of story beats, my expectation is once you get the band together, they should play a gig before getting the bonding around the campfire scene. And that didn't happen. You know, maybe they should have shot a deer and then sat around the campfire and bonded as a team after they did some work. But Baron has to put the exposition somewhere. And this is really the perfect place for it in terms of the pacing of the story. If it doesn't meet the expectations of your classic getting the band together, the story structure.
Yeah, we do get to this point very quickly, actually. And I guess the alternative would have been for Baron to narrate the journey a little bit more than he did, which I wouldn't have minded, because then that would have just been, you know, nature descriptions, thick descriptions of hiking, which I always want to read. But I also get where an editor would probably take a pen to that.
Well, as I said, especially on a reread, this is the only place you could put this exposition for what Baron does for the rest of the story. And it doesn't slow down the pacing at all in my mind. And I kept, this is also the point of the story where I was like, you know, if this were a movie, it would be a slow burn movie. It has a prologue and then two acts where everything pretty much goes really well and everybody meets in their goals. And then there's a third act where everything does not go well. And that's my favorite kind of horror story, really. It's my favorite kind of horror movie. So yeah, even though I saw the scaffolding of the story a little bit, the structure became a little too apparent for me. I easily forgive this sort of thing because I found this whole story to be a constantly wonderful and wicked subversion of all other expectations from start to finish. I had no idea where the story was going at this point.
No, and I honestly, I still kind of feel like I'm not sure where the story went, even though I've read it five times for this episode. Right. And that's not a complaint. That's not a critique. That's a real praise of this story that just kept me just on edge the whole time. I never felt comfortable because all these expectations were being subverted and it kept seeming to change genres. It kept seeming to change types of story on me. And I really appreciated that. It gave me the feeling that horror should give me. It should be uncomfortable. And I liked that.
Yeah, in the sense that anything could happen at any time. And this is one of the few horror stories I've read that really felt that dangerous to me as a reader.
Well, all right, let's actually get Bane's story here. So back in the 1840s, some explorers came to this area. Some of them got killed and some others tried to settle the place, but then just disappeared. But one of them did come back and he wrote a book about it. And then pieces of that book wound up in another book, which is a kind of field guide. It's got a broken circle on black as the cover. And the thing is, the boss back at the camp, McGrath, seems to have a copy of this book, or at least part of the book, because he's given a map from it to Stevens. And it is a map that Bane recognizes. But the question is, what did this explorer find? Well, apparently, he found burial mounds and cliffside caves with bodies in them, but he also found ruins. But Bane doesn't think that these stories are credible, really. But Bane also knows stories from an Indian he's talked to, a man named Ravenfoot. And Ravenfoot says that there are ghosts and evil spirits out here. He says that demons live in holes in the ground and in the rocks and sleep inside big trees in the deep forest where the sun never shines. And what these demons do is sneak up on people when they're sleeping and drag them to hell. And that's the end of Bane's story. And everyone treats this like it's a campfire ghost story. And so now Rourke tells a story of his own, like it's, you know, that's what we're doing here, is taking turns telling stories. And this time the story is the story of Rumpelstiltskin, but with some details changed. And in particular, this story has the discovery of Rumpelstiltskin's name occur in a dark mountain valley where a pack of demons are dancing. But at any rate, that is the evening. They've had their drinks, they've told some stories, and so it's time to sleep now.
Yeah, listen, I'm with you in regard to being on Horn's team here. I used to be able to handle spookiness and scary stuff so much better than I can now. Of course, that just means I enjoy it more because I like scary stuff. But I get rattled so much more easily now than I ever have in my life. Just the other night, I was woken up by like a monstrously loud peal of thunder. And it felt like I woke up into the middle of a night terror. I've never had thunder scare me before, but this one did. So yeah, if I'm out in the middle of an old growth forest with a bunch of boost up lumberjacks, I don't want to hear a scary story on top of it. I don't need it. No, sir.
No. we have been out in the wilderness like this. We've gone backpacking together several times, and we do not tell scary stories, even though we usually do that with someone else who's also a pretty big horror fan. We don't do this. We know better.
Right. It's a bad plan. But, you know, in any event here, Bane's story is awesome, and it's clearly not just a story. It's the exposition that we need for where we're going. You know, I also love this retelling of Rumpelstiltskin, you know, questioning some of the basic premises of that old nursery tale. You know, why does Rumpelstiltskin want a kid? I don't know. It's a solid question. And I'm no expert, though I did watch what felt like three seasons of ABC's show Once Upon a Time. Though when I went back and looked at the season descriptions, it may be the case that I only watched one season. But in any event, that show taught me that maybe Rumpelstiltskin is just misunderstood and wants to be a dad or something, but he's too much of a villain to go about it in the usual way. I don't know. Maybe he fell in love and doesn't know how to handle that. Who can say? As a side note, that show lasted 7 seasons.
Yeah, I watched 5 of them.
5?
but couldn't tell you much about them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a strange show. I really wish they'd have incorporated some of Barron's energy into that show for just like 1 season, or bought this story to incorporate into the show. And that's only because in thinking about how that show handled Rumpelstiltskin and how this story does, it made me think of a really cool mashup between them. And the fact that this story does take us into some dark fairy tale territory, some dark Disney World type stuff. But before we get there, our band of lumberjacks must become huntsmen.
Right. So the next morning, Miller wakes up from a pretty weird dream, and he's certain that he can hear music. It's an orchestra of woodwinds and strings with a choir singing in another language. Now, this is just at the edge of his perception, and it seems to come with the gusts of wind. So, you know, maybe it's far away. But on the other hand, no one else seems to hear it. And so Miller decides that it's not real. It's just in his imagination. But nonetheless, he can't quite shake it. And I think this is probably an experience that most of us have had, or, you know, something akin to it. But anyway, they go hunting now, and by noon, they have killed 4 bucks and wounded a 5th, and the one that they've wounded has run off into the woods. The 2 youngsters, that's Horn and Calhoun, they go after the buck along with Ma, the strong man. Stevens is going to send Miller and Rourke back down to camp with what they've already got, but then they all hear a distress call from the 3 lumberjacks who are chasing the wounded buck. And, you know, this distress call, this changes everything because, you know, now it is time to go help their friends. And they find Horn first. He's been hit on the head and knocked a little bit woozy, but is otherwise all right. What got him was a snare. Someone has put snare traps in this area. But while Horn was struggling to be conscious, someone came up and talked to Ma and Calhoun, and then they went off with that person. And that's actually where the distress call, the rifle shots that they heard, that's actually where that came from. Didn't come from Horn. And Horn can't really explain, but he says that he did not like the sound of this other person's voice. And he's generally pretty terrified right now. So now they're all after Ma and Calhoun, and also this mysterious stranger. 10 minutes later, they come to a fallen red cedar tree, which is a massive type of tree. And this has a symbol carved into it. And if you're wondering if it is a broken circle like on the cover of the book that Bane talked about, well, you're right. It is. That's exactly what it looks like. And it turns out that there are more downed trees around here, and they are all carved with this symbol. When they investigate further, they see that there is actually a door in this tree. Like, you can open it up and walk inside the giant tree. Obviously, they do that, but just as obviously, that's a bad idea. A Miller sees something squirm and uncoil. It's something that he can only describe as a darker piece of darkness. And his companions get everyone out of the tree. They try to seal the door, and just as they are doing this, suddenly, unexpectedly, there is a solar eclipse. And now the world is a strange, shadowy realm. But it only lasts for 4 minutes, so, you know, that's something good at least. And now it is time to keep going after their friends. They follow a trail. The trail leads them to a rustic village, but it's a village that clearly belongs in Europe. It's totally out of place here in the Olympic Mountains. In the middle of the village is a stone tower of bone-white stone, and it's clearly a defensive structure. Now, at this point in the story, there is a section break, so we're going to pause too, but then when we come back, we will see if anyone lives in this village.
Barron's gift for lush description is really on display in this section of the story. One thing that really jumped out to me on a reread is the way that Barron builds tension during the search for Horn, Calhoun, and Ma. He takes the team of hunters, the band, deeper into this old growth forest, and then he contrasts that, you know, sense that they're in just this place where humans never are or should be, with signs that there have been human habitation here. He shows us camps that have been abandoned and, you know, rusted pots and pans. And it's brilliant. And it's really easy to pass over because the pace of the storytelling is really ramping up as we get nearer and nearer to the real horror of the story. But still, at this point, we've met no men from Portlock. And, you know, the conflict is not that somebody's interrupted something. It's that members of the band have gone missing. And the story at this point is really a question of whether or not these men will be able to get the deer back in time for the photographer to promote the camp. It's what it feels like to me, so that the camp can either get more money from investors or just get all bought altogether by a bigger business. It's like these guys work for a lucratively backed tech startup that's hoping to get bought rather than to like become a functioning, well-run business, so they don't sweat the small stuff like labor laws or the well-being of their employees. And so it really becomes clear, I think, at this point of the story, when you, especially with the way the band is interacting, thinking about how they need to get back to camp so they don't get yelled at. Like, the one element of horror is the total disregard for life that seeps its way into the lives of the workers who hope to benefit from the companies, or as we'll see, the cult's success. But then there's also the really obvious horror stuff that we get, the hollow trees and the demons who live in them, broken black circles, doors in the woods where they shouldn't be, and all that stuff is great. I mean, at this point, you also might expect this story to be a dark portal or fairy story. And instead, we end up in this Disney-esque fairy tale village. And I just did not see that coming at all. It really feels like it came out of nowhere. But when you finish the story and go back and read it, it feels inevitable because, as we're about to learn, Miller's band are the men from Portlock.
Right. And this village is actually inhabited, though it does have this feeling, you know, as we get to this section break, it does have this feeling of a set at Disney World, and you know, the animatronic people are just not turned on right now. It's sort of what it feels like to me. But no, this village is inhabited. It's full of women. They're outside doing chores. A woman described as a matron approaches the loggers and says, "Dear gentlemen, you have nothing to fear. Be at peace. The men will soon return from the gathering, and you shall treat with them. Until then, please rest." And she's got a strange accent that I didn't try to imitate there, but she's got a strange accent. And she also says that their community was carried across the sea by our founders when Sir Raleigh still served the Queen's pleasure. So, I don't know, we might need to talk about Roanoke at some point here, but at any rate, the matron won't answer any questions about Calhoun and Ma. She says only that their husbands will be home soon, and it's all more than a little creepy, really. But the loggers don't accept that, and after looking around, they decide to search inside a locked house, and of course, they find Ma in there, but Ma is totally naked, and his guts are spilling out of a wide cut in his stomach. What's worse is that his intestines are hooked up to some kind of pulley system that is slowly pulling them out. And now the matron is here, and she hacks Bane's shoulder with a cleaver and says, "Did you see what's waiting for you in the trees?" Now, she also says that Calhoun is in the tower and explains that they gave us the fat one for sport. It amuses them to watch us practice cruelty. But back outside, our band of hunters, they can't get to the tower. And in fact, they have a big battle with the women. The village ends up on fire. This all happens over about 3 pages. I'll say Baron's writing of the logistics of all of this is quite gripping, so I'm really just paraphrasing here. But the result is that the loggers flee the village, and they flee into a cave that has occult symbols all over the walls. At this point, everyone except Miller is wounded, and Horn is in some pretty bad psychological shape. He starts talking about how this village is surrounded by the sons and daughters of Old Leech, and that the people of the village give them their babies for food. He also thinks that what's going on here is that the villagers' god, which is to say Old Leech himself, is hibernating like a bear. but that Old Leech is waking up now and he's been dreaming about the loggers. A miller falls asleep in the cave, and when he's woken up, it turns out that Horn is gone, but they can hear him moaning, "Help me," from a tunnel that goes deeper into the cave system. But Miller and everybody else, they all agree that what they are hearing is not really Horn. It's someone pretending to be Horn, or something pretending to be Horn. But in any case, it's definitely a trap. Still, after a while, Bane and Rourke decide to go check it out anyway. It works on them. And so now it's just Stevens and Miller at their camp in the cave. And Stevens says that while Miller was sleeping, they had done some exploring. And what they found down this passage was a great cavern with a pillar in the center. All around the base of the pillar was a pile of rocks, except, of course, it wasn't rocks. It was the skulls of human babies. And he could tell that Rourke was afraid, but also kind of compelled. And so at this point, they have probably now seen the last of Rourke and Bane as well. But Miller just wants to wait for sunrise before they try to make a break for it.
You know, with horror movies, you have the opportunity to look away or cover your ears or whatever you need to do to avoid the horror if it becomes overwhelming for you, if you want to. But with horror stories like this, you can't look away because if you do, you won't be able to read the words that move you past the worst of it. And skipping ahead doesn't work either in a story like this one because Baron has already brought us into a flow of a story that's especially hard to guess what's going to happen next because so many of our expectations have been subverted. We've been surprised at every turn of the plot. And so reading this section of the story, I was reminded a little bit of reading Battle Royale, the novel, a feature of which is a list of students who remain alive. And then one of the main drives of that novel is like who and how and you know when are any of these students and characters going to survive. And so as gruesome and grisly as this section is, as well written as the violence is, and as awesome the character as Bane is, you know, putting himself in front of everyone else to try to rescue the squad, as curious as we feel at Miller's seeming invincibility that is getting him through this moment, just as it got him through World War I, my experience reading this is really a feeling of awe of Baron's ability to write something that I both want to look away from, but I can't. And it's really a magnificent feat.
It is. I was so uncomfortable during this whole scene in the cave that I wanted to do all of the things that you were suggesting, skim it, skip ahead, right? That sort of thing. And definitely if this had been a film, I would have been covering my eyes at this point. Elizabeth would have been covering her ears, which means, you know, between us, we have one brain. And so it would have been fine, but it's such powerful writing. There are not very many horror books or horror stories that I read that actually do this for me. And of course, well, you and I have a horror podcast. That's what we're doing here. We read a lot of horror and I don't generally have this experience while reading at all, but I did hear, and it's great. It's awesome.
I think it's really awesome. I also want to say something about Old Leech here. Old Leech is a recurring god type figure in Laird Baron's fiction. This is the only section of his that we've covered, which means, you know, because we do so much reading for the podcast, it's also the only second story of his that we've read. But if we keep going with Laird Baron's stories, we'll run into Old Leech again. I'm sure real fans of Laird Baron and his own, you know, people who love his cosmology that he's come up with are screaming at us for not knowing this. But yeah, that's really cool. But speaking of the weird fiction elements of this story, I want to read a passage that aligns in my mind so well with so much of the other weird fiction stuff that we've covered on the network. For people who are reading along, this is on page 240 and it spills onto page 241. He loves his people. Loves us too in a different way. Horn's smile was shrewd and cruel. He opened his mouth and inhaled the peculiar light, and Miller's dreams became confused. He dreamt of falling through the mountain, through the entire earth, and into the sky, accelerating like a bullet until the light of the sun dwindled to a pinprick. He crashed through the icy, blood-black surface of a strange moon and drifted weightless in its hollow core. The cavern was rank and humid and dark as pitch. He floated over crags and canyons and forests of clabbered flesh and fungus, his body carried upon the updrafts of a warm, gelatinous sea. At the center of this sea, a mountain range shuddered and stirred. The colossus writhed and uncoiled with satanic majesty, aroused by the whine of flea wings. It whispered to him. I mean, this belongs in a dark Clark Ashton Smith story or something. It's just an amazing bit of weird cosmic horror writing.
Yeah, what a great description. I mean, we've got all the senses working here, and the whole thing paints this picture of just real uncomfortable dread. This one sentence in particular that you read, I'm just going to read back to you, Brandon, because it's so awesome. He floated over crags and canyons and forests of clabbered flesh and fungus. I mean, just the alliteration there of F sounds and hard C's there, fa and ka sound, just poetical, just brilliant, beautiful writing.
It's amazing. This was my favorite passage in the story, just because it resonated with so much other great cosmic horror writing, even stuff we find in The King in Yellow, Clark Ashton Smith. I mean, it's just Baron's influences are on display in this moment, but he makes them his own. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and to go back to your point about Old Leech being a part of Baron's mythos, but that this is only the second story you and I have read, so we don't really know Baron's mythos at all. I think that is a point in Baron's favor here, right? In that we don't have to know that for this to work on us. It works really, really powerfully in this story. But if you do know that, then there's an extra element of enjoyment to this, right? It means something to you, or you realize, you just have that excitement, that thrill from realizing that you're in this extended universe of this creator. It's a joy that I think most of us have, you know, when we're doing this kind of reading. But you don't have to be bringing anything. The story can work totally standalone, and this reference just works as a bit of creepiness, because what we really need to get from this, what we need to understand, is that something is wrong with Horn, and he's either having some sort of weird hallucination or is somehow tapped into something else, like psychically. And that's all we need to know. And we figure that out and it works. It's awesome.
And that sense of kind of psychic dread of the uncanny will take us into the final bit of this story.
Yeah. At this point, I was expecting that there was going to be a lot more action to the story as the two who are left here, try to fight their way back to the logging camp. But we actually don't get that. At sunrise, they just walk out of the cave and even walk through the ruins of the village and walk all the way back to the camp uneventfully. But when they get to the camp, they find that it's gone. It's been destroyed. And waiting for them there is a person who identifies himself as Dr. Boris Kalimov. And he looks human, and maybe he was once, but he doesn't seem to be any longer. Dr. Kalimov explains that he and his colleagues, who dwell in the dark, and that's dark with a capital D, they left Stevens and Miller alive so that they could become servants there in the dark. It's fair recompense for the destruction of the village and their cattle. And cattle here is referring to the villagers, the humans. Stevens declines, and he's ready to shoot, but Kalimov explains that if they can't have Stevens, then they'll have to take Stevens' family. And Kalimov even lists off precisely who he means and where they live and what they're up to right now. So Stevens relents, and Kalimov cuts off Stevens' ear with his fingernail, and then he eats it. So Miller, though, declines the offer. He says, "Go ahead and terrorize my distant relations. Meanwhile, I think I'll blow my brains out and be shut of this whole mess." Kalimov tells him to chill out. This isn't what they have in mind for him. They're going to let Miller go. In fact, they've left the lockbox with the logging company's payroll cash for him to take and run off and start a new life with, and also get a new identity. The one caveat is that they expect him to be virile. They want him to make a lot of babies, and they're going to be watching to make sure that he does. And Kalimov then steps backward and rises into the shadows like a spider ascending its thread, and is gone. And this is just a creepy and really effective description from Baron here. And then we get a coda to end this story. Miller gets married, settles down in a small farming town where he works as a gunsmith. He and his wife have a baby, and this means that Miller and his wife are up at night, and when his wife goes into the baby's room to soothe him, Miller lies in bed and listens for the lullabies that his wife sings. But he also watches the shadow of the willow tree out front, the branches writhing like tendrils toward his bed. One morning, he chops down the willow tree and finds that it is rotten inside, and something heavy and multi-segmented shifts and retracts inside the trunk. And that's enough for Miller. He pours kerosene all over it and burns the tree. And the story ends with this line that I just adore. Miller stood in the billowing smoke, leaning on his axe, eyes reflecting the lights of hell.
Yeah, a real victory for Miller, I suppose. Though, as Kalimov suggests, perhaps living is its own sort of punishment after one has seen the things that Miller has seen and lived through. So Miller gets what he wants in the end, I guess. He gets the money from the lumber job. He gets an escape. But the way that he gets it is otherwise too costly. And again, he and his band were the men from Porlock. Their catastrophic deer hunting trip essentially wiped out two communities of people and workers. We get the return of the fairy elements, too, at the end of the story. And I think that this story ends in a really satisfying way. I do want to point out here something that we'll pick up in our discussion. And it's this bit with Stevens's injury. You know, the ear specifically, the ear injury mimics or mirrors an injury that we read about in the prologue. Also, I think that, you know, at the end of the story here, before the epilogue, we see why Baron was so interested in developing the characters in the camp to make this gut punch of their death at the end hit home a little more. I think, you know, maybe different readers with different tastes will debate whether or not that worked. But I think that this whole story really functions on a type of symmetry. So I hope that our listeners will stick around for our discussion episode where we'll look at this craft element and a few other things, too. So that's going to do it for this episode. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. You can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. I want to say thanks again for the commission to do this episode from our really generous Patreon supporter. This story is awesome. We're not done with it yet. So next time, we'll be back with the discussion episode, which I'm super looking forward to. Until then, we greet you and say farewell.